Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. This week on Stagecraft, I'm talking to the actress Adrienne C. Moore. Fans of Orange is the New Black will recognize her from her prominent role as Cindy in all seven seasons of the Netflix series, but she got her start off-Broadway, starring in shows like Milk Like Sugar and, later, Taming of the Shrew in Central Park. Following this summer's release of the final season of Orange is the New Black, she's back on stage as one of the stars of the public theater's production of poet Entozake Shange's famous 1976 theater piece for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. Moore's here in the studio with me to tell us all about how she and her collaborators are bringing together the universal and the deeply personal to bring this landmark theater piece to life. Hi, Adrienne.
Hi,
thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I was saying just before we turn on the mics that For Colored Girls is, for me, and I think for a lot of people, it's one of those plays that we've all heard of, we've probably read, but I've never had a chance to see before. And it's, you know, I've been going to see theater in New York for 20-some years. Mm-hmm. Like, it is sort of such a landmark, and yet it doesn't really get done very often. What did it mean something to you before you signed on to this production, and what was that?
You know, likewise, I hadn't seen a production of it as well. I feel, you know, I remember there was like a PBS, and I think I remember seeing maybe glimpses of it when I was younger, but I had never seen a full production. I had first gotten the piece when I was in high school. I can't remember if a teacher or a neighbor or a family friend had given me the book. Right. But of course, you know, being in high school and just...
Where was this at the time?
This was Atlanta, Georgia, yes. Benjamin Elijah Mays High School. I was busy doing I don't know what, running the streets, playing basketball, who knows. Yeah. But I didn't read it all the way through. I read, you know, selected poems and things like that. But it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I was re-entering back into the arts, and I was looking for audition material, and I had the book in my house. And so I was like, oh, maybe I'll pick some poems and make some monologues, right, you know, out of this. And Lady in Yellow was some of the poetry that I used for monologues. And of course, then that's when I found out, you know, it had this big life in New York. I mean, I didn't grow up in New York, so I didn't really have that enclave of like theater and Broadway like a lot of people did. So the magnitude of it didn't resonate with me until I read it for myself. Right. So it was really interesting to go in this process not having, you know, this map already of what I had seen. Of course I knew, you know, all of the hype about it, but of course I didn't have any visual idea of what this piece was. So it was, I was lucky in that sense. I could approach it very honestly and authentically from what was coming from in me.
Right. And Shange calls it not a play, but a choreo poem. So
absolutely.
So I guess my first question is, how did you perform it when you were auditioning? Did you do movement stuff with it?
No, okay. I feel, you know, and again, this was Adrienne in her 20s. So she was just a bourgeoning, trying to figure it out artist. But I think I played it like I was talking to a girlfriend. And honestly, much of how I play it in the show is like that.
Right.
She's, you know, we are older women, but we are reflecting upon different moments in our lives. And so we tried it different ways where it was like, okay, we are the teenage girls, or we are the adults reflecting upon, you know, a time in our teenage years. So we tried it different ways, and I think we kind of settled on a mix between the two. But if you remember, you know, when you were young and you were telling stories, you were very animated and physical. And yep. So I love the fact that there is a lot of movement in this piece. And it allows, you know, how we as women of color tell stories. And we do tell stories with our bodies and our hands and our just, you know, it's even as I'm talking to you now, like using my body to talk, you know. So
yeah.
I love that. And Camille A. Brown, who is the choreographer for this piece, has really brought an element to the show that is daring and it's bold. And she has this saying that, you know, I try to remember when I am in performance. And she says, you know, I've done my job if you don't look like you're dancing.
Right.
On stage.
Right.
So it's how we use movement in our everyday lives to talk. But yes, how there is sort of a fluidity
right.
to that movement.
And what's your, now that you've worked on it for a while and you're still in it, what's your sense of why this is the right form? It's such an unusual form. Why is this the right form for this, the stories that this piece wants to convey and the experiences?
There's a lot of things that come to mind with that question. First, the idea that almost like music, right? When you have nothing else to say, but a song can really express every emotion and feeling that you're feeling. I think that's what poetry does as well.
Right.
And the movement as well, coupled with that, when you can't express it in words, your body can express it. There are
right.
times where I'm looking at the other women working on their poems, and I just see how naturally movement becomes a part of their expression and in their storytelling.
Right.
And so those are things that I feel is so unique about this being a choreo poem and not just a poem where you stand on stage and talk. You know, when it was originally conceived, it was also very audience participatory because it was this, you know, communal experience of, you know, yes, this is my voice, but it is all of our voices.
Right. Yeah. And the production that you're in right now, it sort of kind of nods to that anyway by sort of putting you in the round. Like, you're surrounded on all sides by the audience, right? Your role is Lady in Yellow, and everybody's named after a color, like the color she is wearing, more than an actual character name.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think of how much of what you are playing is a sort of archetypal experience and how much of it is a specific woman with very specific experiences that, you know, for instance, you talk about in your poem, the poems you have?
Yes. So yellow, when you think about that color, I think about light. I think about energy. I think about power and fueling things like pure energy. And so when I think about my character and her journey through the piece, she definitely is fueling the energy. I mean, the start of the show, you know.
I mean, you kind of start the show, right? You start
that
dance.
I'm clapping. I'm winding up that turbine engine
right.
of women, that rainbow,
yeah.
so to speak. Because it requires a lot of energy, one, just to get through the show, but also to tell these stories, you
yeah.
know, to be honest and be open and be that vulnerable and be that authentic about, you know, the joys and the sadness and the trauma of the experiences of women of color. And I also think about when it comes to light, you know, yes, we do talk about a lot of traumatic, dark moments that women of color experience, but as Ntozake details in the title, you know, a lot of times just people focus on for colored girls, or they focus
right.
on for colored girls who have considered suicide.
Right.
But what I want the light to be in this is that who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. And so it's like they're moving past that. They're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And there's
right.
this beautiful song that we sing that talks about, oh gosh, I have to sing it to like remember the lyrics.
Okay.
But I'm like, with hands in holding, tongues in clear. It's actually a very sexual song.
Oh, all right.
But
we're all adults here. It's fine. Yeah.
That's a TBD. You have to come
yeah.
see the show.
All right.
But yeah, we talk about these very dark moments, but then the celebration of moving through those dark tunnels into the light and seeing the brightness at the end of at the rainbow.
Right. And what's your sense of the movement that you mentioned Camille A. Brown, who was the choreographer on Once on This Island and Choir Boy. And what's your, for people who haven't seen the show yet, how do you sort of characterize the style of movement? Is it? And do you have a lot of dance experience? That's my other question.
You know, I was that kid that danced when I was a kid. So
right.
middle school, high school. But by high school, I started transitioning more into sports.
Right.
I love to dance. It's something that's a passion of mine. And I feel, you know, the body and dance is a great expression of the inner self. And that's, I think, what Camille tries to embody in each of the movement. I mean, most times, and I've done musicals where, you know, you come in and the choreographer already has pieces right. that they've choreographed and so forth, and she doesn't start like that.
Right.
You know, she starts with a gesture. She has us come up with five gestures, something that relates to the movement, or I'm sorry, that relates to the poetry,
right.
something that, you know, evokes something in us.
Right. So it's generated by you, this
stuff. It's totally generated by us, and how she puts it together is just incredible. Right. And then she's really big on levels. Like, she doesn't want everyone standing up. She wants to see you down on the ground. She wants to see you bending. She wants to, you know, really show within the different levels the complexity of how we walk through life. You know,
right.
we don't always walk through life standing tall. There are moments where we are, you know, down and on the ground and we can't pick ourselves up. And so what does that look like in the body? So she literally starts the process this is how she started the process. So who's afraid of dance? That was the first question she asked us.
How many of you raised your hands?
I did a cartwheel.
Yeah.
I said, me, cartwheel. I said, but I love it.
Right.
I love it because I love what it can express. And so she said, okay, well, I'll have done my job when it looks like you're not dancing.
Right.
And so then from there, she asks for gestures. And when I think of a word, what does that translate to me in my body? And so that's how she builds her choreography. And I think it's risky. I think it's bold. I think it's also very scary. And I'm all up for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the costumes in this. Everybody has these, you know, everybody's wearing a different color. You're
yes.
the lady in yellow. But there are also these faces
yes.
printed on them. And where do they come from?
They're
and tell us about them.
Beautiful
they
faces.
Are. Yeah.
They are beautiful faces of women in our lives that have impacted us greatly. So some of the women have their mothers, their mm-hmm. grandmothers. I have my grandmother, Mabel Moore, my paternal mothers on my dress because to me, she was a Leo like
mm-hmm.
myself. and as a kid, you know, I thought she was just mean and stern and strict. And, you know, you come into her house, she was like, sit there. And, you know, she had like the plastic furniture. And,
sure.
And the one, you know, TV channel that was black and white that only showed Andy Griffith. And you couldn't turn. And I was like, oh, my grandmother is mean. But then as I grew older, she passed when I was a young girl. So then my memories of her became stories from other people.
Mm.
And I hear, you know, her growing up in the South and raising 11 children and literally moving her family from a 3-room house while her husband, my grandfather, was off traveling and, you know, he played for the Negro Baseball League and he mm-hmm. built railroads. She literally moved them into a home, which at that time, being a woman and being from the South, you know, you couldn't sign the deed on your own home. You had to wait for your husband, but she
right.
figured out a way
wow.
to get a house and move them in. And so when I hear those stories about her strength and how, you know, they didn't have a lot, but yet she not only fed her family, but she fed the kids in the neighborhood that couldn't eat.
Wow.
You know, so as I've gotten older, I hear stories about her strength and how much of a leader she was. And so I chose to put her on my dress.
Yeah.
So every night I walk in her spirit and I walk in her fearlessness.
Yeah. You're sort of glowing with that. Like, I can tell it, like,
yeah,
like
absolutely.
Affects
that
you
was,
as you're walking out
a,
on that stage.
It was
stage.
Such a beautiful way to embody. I mean, even in the you know, the clothes, like, you think, oh, they're just clothes we wear. I mean, and we're sweating in them. But
sure.
but even in that, just the fact that so much thought was put into, you know, what even the wardrobe and how that will feed us
right.
in the performance each night, I thought was just very considerate.
Yeah. So the show was premiered in the 70s in 76.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of how that played at the time, and what's your take on how it plays now with the world being what it is in 2019?
Well, in the 70s, it definitely was a shocker
yeah.
to a lot of people, and especially men of color. They didn't receive it too well because I think they thought it was bashing them.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't bashing them. It was just finally being able to speak the truth. And
mm-hmm.
and I think Ndzaki wasn't trying to bash anyone. She was just trying to finally give a voice to women who were voiceless at a time where, you know, I think as women of color, you know, we're always supposed to be the backbone, you know, the strength. And that's true, and we are, and we definitely hold that space. But there are moments where we're weak, and there are moments where we hurt, and there are moments where we have trauma, and we want to be able to talk about it. And we don't always want to be strong, and we don't always want to, you know, hold our tongue when there are things that bother us or trouble us or hurt us. And so when it first was received in the 70s, there was sort of this liberation and celebration of, yes, finally being able to speak and voice our truth. But then there was a lot of backlash of, you know, you're not supporting us and you're not upholding us and things like that. So that was a doozy. And then you move into 2019, where you have more freedom and less apology about, you know, who you are authentically and how you show up in the world. And so I think it's, you know, it's one of those pieces that I think will always stand the test of time, no matter when it is presented. Even in 20 years, if we've moved the litmus, you know, further along, and there's not so much of a challenge with Me Too movements and women's equality and Time's Up and so forth, you know, I hope in 20 years we'll be able to get to a place where, you know, it won't be so much of a challenge. But even then, I still think these words will resonate with women.
Yeah. I'm talking to you pretty early on in your preview process. Mm-hmm. What so far for you has been the biggest challenge of this piece?
That's a lot. You know, I love theater because I call it my gym. Mm-hmm. It's a place where...
Someone just said that on this podcast a couple weeks ago.
Really? I mean, and it's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, what it requires of you physically, emotionally, you have this fourth wall every night that's coming in and you don't know how they're going to receive it.
Right.
But they're so necessary to complete the picture. So for me, I think... aside from, you know, just making sure my body can literally get through the show, it's making the language new to me every night, you know, and what I love about the poetry and what I love about these words is that I'm discovering something every night.
Right.
And it's evolving me, and it's allowing me to go deeper into the text, deeper into the experience of these women, deeper into the experience of women in general. I mean, it's not just me that's talking. I feel like, yes, I am talking for a generation of women, for a women, a people of color, right. You know, and not just Black women, but Latina women, Asian women, Native American women. I mean, Martha Redbone, who's the composer in our piece, is Native American, and this even resonates with her and the experiences that she's had as a woman growing up. So I feel, my grandmother, you know, I feel all of this. We do this song called Souls of Black Folk, where it's literally like we're conjuring and bringing up our ancestors and like their pain and what they went through, you know, in this, you know, in their diaspora. So it's knowing that, yeah, there's a lot of weight to this, but then to have the freedom and the fun and the play of it all, and to keep it alive and new and fresh every night.
Yeah. So you mentioned the music. The music is entirely new. It's original for this production.
Yes.
Yeah, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And those songs, are they labeled? It's been years since I've actually read that piece.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are they called songs in the script? Or was it a decision that you all came to that, oh, this should be song?
Yeah, that was a decision that, Martha Redbone and Leah would probably be the perfect people to ask that question to.
This is Leah Gardner, who's the director.
But what I have gleaned from conversations is that Ntozake wrote new poems that she wanted to see sung. And so when this piece was being commissioned in the very beginning, Leah, our director, when she hired Martha, the composer, said that, you know, Intozaki has new poems that she wants to put music to. And then the I Found God and I in Myself and I Loved Her Fiercely is sort of like the anthem, the women's anthem song. Yeah. And so she found a beautiful way to take literally those two lines and make a beautiful song out of them.
Yeah. And how, you say new poems, but how new? When did she write these?
She wrote them. She's always, and she meaning Intozaki, has always had the desire for this piece to be evolving.
Right.
Never steadfast, never, you know, stuck in a time capsule.
Yeah, yeah.
She always wanted to see it more from generation to generation. So even after it was written, she was still writing new pieces for it. And I did a few workshops before she passed, and there were even new poems
for
in there.
This project, for this production specifically.
Well, at the time, you know, they can't tell us whether or not they were going to do the production,
but I think they were
trying to bring it together.
Got it.
And with that, they had some private workshops, and she had brought some pieces that had written and was considering adding to the new production. One of the things I feel like I want to say about this is that She Intozaki didn't want to see a revival of For Colored Girls. She wanted to see it reimagined. Mm. And I think that speaks to her desire to always want to keep it fresh and new and on the lips of a younger generation.
Right.
You know, and so with this new poetry that she wanted and even wanted to see it, you know, in a song format, I think is just a testament to the idea of this is always changing, and this can always be relevant, no matter when it's presented.
Yeah. And for you, in terms of where you are in your life and your career, you just fairly recently wrapped up 7 seasons on Orange is the New Black. Why, you touched a little bit on why theater is important to you to get back to, but why did it feel like this piece in particular was right for you for your next thing?
I hadn't done theater since, I think it was season 4 or 5 of Orange, and I missed it. I really missed being in theater. I mean, it's tough.
Which one was that? Was that Taming of the Shrew?
At the public. Yeah. Great memory.
Well, I do what I can.
Great memory. But I did miss it. And so I knew that I wanted to do something in theater. And then, yes, coming off of a show like Orange is the New Black that was revolutionary in its sense, it's kind of hard to just take anything after that, you know, because you realize the impact that it had not only on my life and the people that watched the show, but the world. Right. And so when you take a piece like For Colored Girls, who have considered suicide when the rainbow was enough, and you also know the impact that it, you know, had. I know the impact that it had on me. I know the impact that it had on women of color, and I know the impact that it had in the theater world. It just seemed like it was the perfect segue or thing to kind of speak to, continue in that vein of doing work that is meaningful, that is impactful, that says something.
Right. Yeah.
So that's why I chose it.
And then what? And
or
so
it chose me. I should say.
Yeah. And so what guides you now is you, where do you feel like Orange is the New Black has sort of put you in terms of where you are in your career and the kind of stuff that you want to do next?
Orange is the New Black has made it hard for me. No, not hard, but it's definitely made it challenging in that, you know, when you see, as I said, when you see the impact of what something can have, that's the only thing you want to look for.
Right.
You know, you don't want to do, you know, theater or television or film for the sake of just doing it because you know you're going to, you know, make a paycheck. You want to do it because it really is art. It really is speaking something. It really is speaking a truth that may be uncomfortable for some, but also liberating for others. And so when I look at things, I think about, you know, how does this sit in my spirit? And then what is it that I can contribute to this? And what is it saying? And what can I say with this piece?
What one super cool thing that you did recently that I just found out about, actually, is you're voicing the you're in the new Wonder Woman animated film, which is super cool. You're playing Etta Candy. That's awesome.
The first African American Etta Candy. Right? Yes.
And what was appealing about that? Are you
the first African American woman to play Etta Candy? Yeah, but still going along that vein of, you know, how can what I do be different and impactful and unique? Right. And, you know, I think Etta Candy is just as beloved a character as Wonder Woman. Yep. And, you know, she kind of holds the fort down and she's smart and she's funny and she's has this wry sense of humor and she's quick and she doesn't let anything get past her, which is me all day long. And so when they brought this project to me, I immediately said yes, because Wonder Woman was something that I watched, you know, as a kid. And then, you know, speaking to this new horizon that we are on where, you know, superheroes can look like anything and anyone, and they don't have to be, you know, just a white man or a white woman, and they don't have to necessarily fly in the air, you know, they could be someone that is behind the computers and they're cracking codes and they're deciphering things and figuring it out.
Like Etta, right?
Like Etta, while snapping the finger, but like, hey, I see you over there. And she's also lesbian in the I don't want to give away everything.
Oh, spoiler.
Yes, you have. Yeah. I know. Well, it's out now, so people can start seeing
it. Just came out,
But watching it and seeing how they, meaning Warner Brothers and the DC Comics brand, is unapologetic in how they want to tell stories is I'm just truly honored to be a part of that experience and that history.
Right.
So, and then, you know,
Rosario Dawson plays
Wonder Woman.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's just, I love being in this generation now that, you know, we just say what we say and speak how we feel and if it offends you, I'm sorry, but I love you.
Yeah. And so you're in for Colored Girls through December 1st, I believe. What's next for you after that?
I am moving into a space of creator.
Oh, wow.
And I have some projects that I am pitching. So I will be pitching some television show ideas that I have.
As a writer, producer, kind of creator? Yeah.
As a producer, I am writing a one-woman show.
Oh, wow. For the stage. Great.
But I definitely see it like a special. But it's delving more into this idea of what it means to be a black woman in America, and how, you know. So the title that I'm working with right now is I Want to Be a White Woman.
Uh-huh.
Yes, Gordon.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, let's do it.
But it honestly deals with this deep desire of, and don't get me wrong, I love myself and I love being African American and I love all the things about my culture, but I also constantly feel as if I have to, you know, constantly tell myself that I love myself and you are beautiful, because I'm being faced every day with something that is dissonant from who I am and different from what I am.
Right.
Which is why I have to reinforce the self-love.
Right.
And so I really want to put out there those things that I think we subconsciously don't see in our society today, you know, through our marketing, through, you know, the stories that we tell on television, to who we choose to be leading men and women, you know, in our storytelling today.
Right.
And so I want to talk about that candidly, but also, you know, in a very humorous way, because I think humor is a great way to talk about difficult topics, and colorism and race and sexuality and beauty and all those things are things that I'm covering in this in this one woman. Yeah.
And when will we see this? Do you know?
Well, we are talking to some people right now.
Great. For the stage.
Yes.
Okay, great.
But I think it's also gonna have a life on the screen.
Sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I asked this of a lot of people as my last question on the podcast, which is, if there was any role in the theater that you could play right now or a little further down the line, what's your sort of bucket list part on stage?
So I've always had this dream of bringing the story of Tituba
to
the stage as a musical.
done.
Done, let's, right, Gordon?
Yeah, right?
Tell whoever you know to come okay. holler at me. But that is I play, when I was in graduate school, we did The Crucible.
Sure.
And I was Tituba, and I fell in love with her and her story. And I read this book by, I may be pronouncing it wrong, but Marise Kondo, who wrote I, Tituba, Black Witch of Salem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
beautiful, beautiful book. And so I would love to see that on a stage one day.
Great.
And me playing Tituba.
Yeah. Let's make it happen, Broadway.
All right. Let's make it happen.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being here. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks, Adrian. Thank you so much, Gordon. Yeah.
That was Adrian C. Moore, now starring on stage in For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough, running at Off-Broadway's Public Theater through December 1st. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, please help us find other theater-loving listeners by telling a fellow Broadway fan, or by rating and reviewing us on your podcatcher of choice. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.